Good morning. Good morning, everyone. My name is Lama. Welcome to the Kadampa Center. Would you like to join me in some prostrations? If you feel uncomfortable doing so, just remain seated. So we'll just be doing three to the altar. So if you'll take out the gold prayer book that's behind your chair. If you're sitting in the back, the back rows, there may not be a gold prayer book, but there's a white binder. So just go to the first page that says Kadampa Center Prayers. And we'll chant Shakyamuni Buddha's mantra on page 183 in the gold book. 183. You see the mantra between two lines. Tayata Om Mune Mune Maha Munaye Soha. Tayata Om Mune Mune Maha Munaye Soha. Tayata Om Mune Mune Maha Munaye Soha. Then turn to page 34 in the same gold prayer book, and we'll read the Four Immeasurables in English one time. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. Then turn to page 37. And you see two mantras at the bottom, Chenrezig's mantra and Green Tara's mantra. So Chenrezig is the Buddha of great compassion, and Green Tara is the enlightened being. She represents enlightened activity. So let's chant Chenrezig's mantra 8 times, and then Green Tara's mantra 7 times, keeping in mind the people on the prayer list and those in your hearts and minds. Om Mani Padme Hum. 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 Taritu Taritu Re Soha. Om 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 Taritu Taritu Re Soha. Okay, the children are welcome to go to their classes now. Thank you for being so patient.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Robbie Watkins. In case you don't know me, I'm the center director here, and I'm going to kick off our celebration of our Sangha today. We're having Sangha appreciation today. We're using Sangha in the terms of the robed members of our community. Here in Raleigh, North Carolina, we've created the incredible merit to have a quite vibrant community of robed practitioners, and this is of unspeakable benefit to Kadampa Center. They are the heart and soul of the center, and every day we should just rejoice in their presence. For those of you who don't know our Sangha members, I'll give you a quick rundown. Our first resident teacher is Geshe Gelug, who is traveling. I guess he's in Nepal now. He'll be back later this year. And then we have Geshe Sampo, who was here earlier today, but I don't think he's going to be coming in this morning. They are both official teachers recognized by the FPMT, the organization we're part of. Their official title is Resident Teachers, and they are supported by the center. They're on our payroll. We pay their health care, insurance, and things like that. So there are two resident teachers. Then we also have other Sangha members. Even though she's not here, I'll introduce Venerable Tendron, who is a center member who took robes how long ago? 10 years ago, at least. 13 years. And she's on loan to another FPMT center in Florida, but we're hoping she'll come back at some point. Then we have Venerable Lamo. And then a lot of people don't know Venerable Condro, who is now here working with the Liberation Prison Project. Then we have Venerable Chuki, and we have Venerable Kondo. We have Venerable Condro and Venerable Kondo. So these are the members of our Sangha community, and like I say, they are the heart and soul of the center. In many ways, you could say the center exists to support the serious practitioners. I think of it as a series of circles. We have a lot of stuff around the outside, then there are other programs on the inside, other programs, and then in the center, you have the people who are practicing seriously, and for their own benefit, for the benefit of the center, and for the benefit of all sentient beings. So it is just a great privilege to have all of them here. They're not employees of the center. They're not here to work for the center or have particular jobs, though many of them volunteer. Venerable Lamo leads our pujas, and Venerable Kondo does. I mean, they all do a lot of volunteering, like so many people here at the center do, but that's not their job. They're not center employees, and we don't boss them around and tell them what to do. Their job is, if I could be so bold as to say, is to keep their vows and to follow the wishes of their teacher. And everything else is subsidiary to that. And so sometimes you'll see them here at the center for teaching. Sometimes you won't see them here. Doesn't mean they've made an editorial decision that they don't want to come or they do want to come. They're always following the guidance of their teachers as to be what would be most beneficial for them. And by doing so, they're creating an incredible amount of merit, an incredible amount of good karma, both for themselves and for the whole center and everyone who comes into contact with them. So it's always appropriate to say thank you to our Sangha members. Financial offerings during pujas or at other times are always appropriate. Treat them with the respect that they deserve. Acknowledge the path that they've chosen to follow and rejoice in the merit that they're creating. So with those words, I'm going to turn the mic over to Venerable Kondo.
I don't stand and talk well because I can't do two things at the same time. Walking and chewing gum has always been a challenge. So I'm going to sit. And so what I've been asked to do today is, since there's actually, we've had the privilege of five nuns ordaining at the center. One nun, unfortunately, passed actually at a really young age, in her mid-50s, I believe, in not even mid-50s, maybe early 50s in India, Venerable Chuni, who was the first member of the center to ordain, and she ordained with His Holiness the Dalai Lama in India. So there's four of us actively kind of here now, but we've had the good fortune to have five women ordain who have been center members. So we're grateful to the center that we were able to do this. So what I've been asked to do is tell you how nuns happened. It's an interesting story in and of itself. The original renunciates, or people that went into homelessness, were already in homelessness. They were spiritual seekers like the Buddha, that after the Buddha was enlightened, and they decided they liked what he had to say, and so they joined him, and so they became, quotes, the first monks. But there were no women, and so the Buddha had gone, he was visiting his family, and it wasn't necessarily a great welcome. I mean, this history might be helpful. It wasn't necessarily a great welcome when he went off to visit his family. The person that welcomed him the most initially was his stepmother, whose name was Maha Pajapati Gautami. She was the sister of his birth mother, Maya, who died 7 days after he was born. And so Maha Pajapati raised him, and so when his wife wouldn't go and greet him, Rahula, his son, was sent off to see him. But Maha Pajapati welcomed him. And then everybody kind of came around once the Buddha started talking. Well, she, on another visit, went to him and said, "Lord, wouldn't it be good if women could renounce their homes, enter into homelessness under the Dharma and discipline of the Tathagata?" And the Buddha said, "Don't set your heart on women being able to do this." I would say the current vernacular for that would be, "Don't even think about it." But she persisted and asked two more times. And he said no. And she bowed and left respectfully, but in tears. Well, shortly after that, the Buddha and his group of monks that were with him at the time left to go to Vesali. And shortly after he left, she, and there were quite a few women with her that also wanted to renounce the householder's life. And they shaved their heads and put on saffron robes and walked 150 miles to Vesali, where the Buddha was staying in the Great Grove. And she stood outside the gates of the grove, kind of, and at that point she looked kind of messy. She was dusty, her feet were swollen, and she was crying. And Ananda came out, who was one of the Buddha's closest disciples and kind of right-hand person, so to speak, and said, "Pajapati, what's wrong? You know, you're crying." And she said, "Well, the Buddha will not let women renounce their homes, enter into homelessness under the discipline, the Dharma and discipline, the Tathagata." And Ananda, being very kind, said, "Well, let me go talk to him." So he did. And using the same phrase as Mahapajapati had used, said, "It would be good, Lord, if women could renounce their homes, enter into homelessness, etc., etc." And the Buddha quickly responded, "Ananda, do not set your heart on women being allowed to do this." And of course, he asked two more times, and Buddha's response was the same. And And, well, Ananda was not one to give up. And so he thought to himself, maybe I'll take a different approach. And so he said, well, Lord, is it true that women can attain enlightenment? And the Buddha said, well, of course, Ananda. Yes, it is. And so Ananda said, well, you know, your stepmother was really, really, really kind to you, and she raised you and suckled you at her breast, and so have many women made it possible for people to grow and be alive. Wouldn't it be good if they could enter into homelessness? And the Buddha said, well, if they're willing to agree to 8 special conditions, I will allow women to do this. And so Ananda, knowing that the answer would, said, okay, let me check it out. And he went to Mahaprajapati, and she heard the 8 conditions, and she went, yep, we'll do it. I'm not sure it was said quite that way, but that's the gist of it. And so Mahaprajapati Gotami, and the stories vary. Sometimes it's 100 women, sometimes it's 500 women, sometimes it's a great group of women were allowed to ordain. And I think that what's special about that is that, I'm not going to go into it, it doesn't matter what the 8 conditions are, but it really, women not only had to agree to all of the things that were asked of men who became monks, but the conditions made life even stricter for women in order to succeed in their vows. And Mahaprajapati and these women were willing to do anything in order to renounce the householder's life and enter into homelessness. So as a nun sitting here today, who I assure you probably wouldn't have made the grade, really, I'm really, really grateful to these beings that were so committed to what the Buddha had to offer, that they would do whatever it took in order to be allowed to follow in his path. And that's the story. Thanks.
And now we're opening the program to our nuns to talk, each of them individually, as they choose, to talk a little bit about their lives as nuns and or what motivated them to take vows.
Donna, can I interrupt? Would it be, even though it would take us 30 seconds, would it make sense to turn it around? I mean, do people mind if we take 30 seconds to turn us around? Would that be okay? Do you mind being turned around,
ladies? We could...
I'll just stay out of the way.
There. Thank you.
Thank you for your patience.
What, do you want me to do it first? I can tell.
We need to use the microphone because we're streaming.
All right, okay. Hello. You can tell I'm not from here because I have a bit of a Scottish accent. Not too bad, though. I hope you understand me, okay? My name is Kandro. I took my vows at Kopan Monastery with Chetsun Soje Lobsang Tenjin Rinpoche. And he gave me vows after reading a very plaintive two-page letter begging for my vows, because where I lived in Scotland, I didn't have a Rinpoche who was my constant teacher. So it was impossible for me to get my vows any other way. So someone had to be kind enough to do that. So I owe him a great deal of thanks. But in the letter, I explained to him my reasons for taking my vows. And I think for that, for you guys to know who I am and why I became a nun, it's important because it shows the kind of person I am. I was raised in a Christian home, and my mother was the secretary of the church, so she had people were coming in and out of the house all the time. And we were part of the church choir, the church band, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, you know how you get all involved in that kind of thing. And missionaries would come into the house. I thought their life was so cool. You know, I thought, wow, I want to do that. You know, and Mother Teresa is like really inspired me. And people that seemed to have like a noble cause that was other than themselves. And my grandmother was a nurse, and so I was used to that kind of mentality in my household. But then I was told by the Christians I wasn't qualified. Now, I'm stubborn, okay? I'm Scottish after all, right? And I'm going, they're not going to tell me I can't do this, right? And so I kept that little secret in my heart for many, many, many years, that this is what I really wanted to do. And I did what I was told and what I was expected. I got married, had two children, failed at it miserably because I'm not very good at picking husbands at all. So, but I had two very lovely boys who are now very much grown up. One's almost 40, the other one's in his late 20s. And as we kind of went through that sort of life, I saw how much suffering was happening, that there were things that were repeating over and over and over in my own life. And I desperately wanted to know, how do I solve this? And that dream would come back of me wanting to dedicate my life to others, not only to benefit them, but to understand where my suffering was coming from. Now, I didn't have a pleasant childhood, and I won't go into that, but I knew that there had to be an answer somewhere, that it surely wasn't like this all the time. And after a series of very unfortunate events, one of my friends, who I have since lost track of, a casual acquaintance, and I wish I could thank him because he would be so amazed, suggested I go to the Sakya Center in Seattle, which is where I lived at the time. And so I went in there, and Sakya Trinzin was teaching the Dharma, and some of the older Rinpoches were teaching the Dharma. And they helped me and my son survive a very difficult time. And I promised then to repay the kindness, but I didn't know how. So I took refuge. And when I took refuge, I was given a name, which I won't say because it's not important, but and I wondered how I was going to live up to that, because that name was so beautiful and so powerful. And so I just kind of carried on studying, as you do, not thinking too much more of it. And I thought, well, maybe that little dream's still there. Maybe it hasn't died altogether. And so I kept studying, raising my son, because my other son had since moved away, and took him to Scotland with me. And then I studied with Geshe Tashi Tsering for 8 years. And I went to India for the first time all by myself. I'd never been to India. I'd never been anywhere, actually, other than Scotland. And so I'm sitting on the airplane going, what am I doing? Why am I going to this strange country? And I don't even speak the language. Do they speak English? I had no idea. I had not a clue. I got off the plane, was met by the monks that I was sponsoring at the time. They were so happy to see me. And I saw Sarah J. Monastery for the first time. And I thought, oh, this is interesting. I can test this. I can see how they live and kind of get an idea, maybe a little bit. And when I told Paldun, who is my dear, dear, he's Nepalese, but I call him my brother. He calls me Didi, which is a Nepalese word for our older sister. We've known each other for about 10 years now, and we're as close as any family can be. And when I told him of my dream, he got to work. First he asked Nyingma Abbott, and then Nyingma Abbott said yes, but I had to wait a year because he was away traveling at the time. And he says, no, that's not good enough. And so then he went to Rinpoche, and he says, give me a letter. And in the letter, I told him the story of my son, who had been abused by his father. We went to the monastery, and the monks had helped my child and saved my child's life and mine. And that was my reason for my compassion, that I wanted to repay that. That was my inspiration. It's kind of, I could still see, you know, the healing going on in my son because of those monks. They were so kind, so loving, so gentle. Just exactly the way we should be to each other, treat each other like real family. They didn't see him as a stranger. And so I told Rinpoche the story, and he said that Rinpoche cried when he read my letter and said, yes, of course you can come. So he phones me and tells me to come to Kathmandu and take my vows. And on that day, someone asked me on my way out the door after my vows were finished, well, what are you going to do now? And I hadn't thought past that because I never thought that dream was going to happen because I thought, oh, I don't know. And long story short, I ended up selling my home, using that money to build a hospital in Nepal. Totally crazy. And people are saying, you know, How daft is that? I mean, you've got no place to go. You've given up your job. I was making good money. But it wasn't making me happy. The Dharma was the only thing that made me happy. It was the truth. It was the path. There was nothing else. I did not want to be distracted by anything else that I was doing. And so I saw that dream slowly, slowly, slowly coming true through the kindness of other people. Not through any effort of mine. I mean, I studied, but I can't take credit for that. But because of my son and what he went through, his pain and suffering brought me to the Dharma. My pain and suffering brought me to the Dharma. The kindness of all these other people brought me to the Dharma. And that enabled me to become a nun. So I have to be so grateful to everyone. And now when I work for LPP, I see the prisoners. They're my brothers. They need my help. They need my love, my compassion. They need me to understand how to talk to their mind and free them from suffering. And they have to do that themselves. I can't do that. I'm not like waving a magic wand or anything. I'm just telling them, go that way. Just like somebody did for me. So it goes in ripples, you know, little drops. Just, it keeps going. And so that's my inspiration for continuing to be a nun and being devoted to the Dharma. Because it's the truth. And it does work. So that's my little spiel. I mean, there's lots more, but I try not to bore you too much. Come on. I said mine, you go.
Good morning. I'm Chuki, and I've been coming to Kadampa Center since 2003, and that was my first introduction to the Dharma, coming into Kadampa Center in the basement there. And one of the things I love about having a collection of us up here is that each one of us, you know, is really coming from a different perspective, and it just shows there are lots of possible roads, lots of possible ways to progress along the path. And most people, when I most ordained Westerners, when I hear their stories, starts out something like, I always thought I was going to be a nun or, you know, something like that. And that wasn't the case for me. I never wanted to be a nun. I never thought about that as a kid or even as a young adult or, you know. But what happened for me was when I came to Kadampa Center in 2003, I was coming from a pretty selfish motivation. I was suffering and looking for something to help me. I had a lot of anger and really struggled with being angry. And I was seeking something. I didn't know what. And I started taking Discovering Buddhism and learned some tools that really helped me. I tried applying them. I'm sure many of you know what I'm talking about. And they worked sometimes. It was really shocking. And so it was very encouraging to keep trying, you know. And so over time, as I studied more, I just began to see that things were helping me. And I had read somewhere that the quickest path to realizing this was to give up the householder's life, become ordained. And I happened to be in a good position to do that. I wasn't married. I didn't have kids. And so I started thinking about it. It was just a small idea at first that I didn't share with anybody. And then Venerable Tendrin, I had a conversation with her about it, just kind of dipping my toe in, you know. And then over time, as I was contemplating, I'm so deliberative. This was, you know, I'm talking about several years that all of this took place. So then I talked with Geshe-la about it and, you know, was kind of exploring. And then I did I believe it was a 3-week retreat at Srivasti Abbey out in Washington State. They have once a year a program called Exploring Monastic Life, and it's for people who are considering ordination or have recently been ordained. And so that was really helpful for me to figure out which parts was I comfortable with and where was I still struggling. And then in a conversation with Geshe-la, we talked about, well, what would it look like to be ordained, what did I want to do with it? And so I decided that I would go to Dharamsala and study Tibetan. I wanted to be able to actually be a translator. And so I'd made up my mind that it was time for a decision. I was giving myself one more year, and at the end of that year, I was either going to ordain or quit thinking I might and move on. And so I went to Dharamsala and found that I really thought it would work for me. And so told Geshe-la, yeah, that's what I wanted to do. And so he arranged for me to ordain with his teacher, Ken Rinpoche, who's in this picture right here. It was fantastic, and I haven't looked back, and it's been a good choice for me. I certainly know it's not the thing for everyone. I'm not up here encouraging it, but I'm grateful that I've had the opportunity. It's definitely a very solid path for me. And I guess one more piece of the story is that after I ordained, I lived at Tosamling, which is a nunnery that His Holiness the Dalai Lama has sort of sanctioned as the place to go if you don't have if you're not connected in some other way with some place after you ordain, then it's a good place to stay for a couple of years after you ordain to sort of get the training. And so I was there for almost a year, but I got sick and had to come back. So my intention had been to stay longer, so I wasn't able to finish my language studies. I only was able to do the first year and a half or so. Maybe one day, we'll see. But really quickly, I just wanted to talk about, for me, the advantages of being in robes, like why I say it's a good solid path for me, and that is, there's no doubt that I practice more, that I think about the Dharma more, all of those things because of being ordained and feeling like there's a certain responsibility that comes with that. You know, sometimes people say to me, isn't it so hard with this list of all these things that you're not supposed to do? And it's, if you look at it like that, it's probably going to be pretty hard to stay in robes, you know, if it's just that I've got this long list of things I can't do. Today I can't do this. Today I can't do that. And instead, if you look at it as protection, like I've got some clear guidelines about the direction of my life. I've made this choice, you know, voluntarily. This is what I've chosen to do. And so now I've got these guidelines that help me follow that, you know. And so it feels much more like a protection rather than, you know, a list of things that are like holding me back or something. And you know, I dress like this every day. I don't just do this on Sundays. You know, I mean, this is what I look like all the time. And so if I'm at Walmart and I'm frustrated at the person behind the counter and I kind of lose my temper with them, everyone's seeing this, you know, not being so pleasant. And so, of course, sometimes that happens. I mean, I'm, you know, it's embarrassing, but I'm not, you know, I'm not there yet. I'm a work in progress. But it really does help me pay a lot more attention than I think I would if I was wearing a sweatshirt and jeans, you know. So I'm really grateful to sort of have that in mind. Thanks.
Okay, well, here's an example. Venerable Lama is a senior nun, and my choice was for her to go first, but she handed me the mic. So as a senior nun, here I am. As her being the senior nun, here I am. Let's see, let's try and make this brief. I met the Dharma here in 2001 under the guidance of, under the iron hook of Venerable Rabina, because Geshe-la was away and she was teaching for a couple of weeks. This is how things work, and the thing that's important is if a neighbor said, hey, I hear this wild nun is going to be talking at this place. Do you want to go? And I said, sure. And it was when we were in the basement, so it was next to impossible to find. It was kind of like trying to find a hobbit door in a tree, and of a very thick wood. But we were able to get there, and she never came back, and I never left. You know, so ding-dong, karma delivery. I started coming to the center pretty regularly and had the and danced around of the thought of ordination. And I remember one time saying to Geshe-la, you know, when I was seriously thinking about it, you know, I should be like this other nun that ordained and just give up everything and not worry about, you know, consequences and stuff and just go ahead and ordain, you know. And he looked at me and said, no, don't do that. You have to do it with a plan. You have to do it with a plan. And of course the idea faded, but I, in the summer of 2013, I had never taken highest yoga tantra initiation before because I knew I was a wimp and probably would have difficulty keeping the commitments. And I'd asked Geshe-la about taking this initiation. I thought I was finally ready, and it was with Chodron Rinpoche in Boston, and he approved. And so I went, and there was a week of teachings the following week. And during that week, you know, I'd heard a lot about a thing called guru devotion and devotion to your teacher. And, well, not being the most obedient person in the entire world, guru devotion really didn't grab me or float my boat. And but I finally got it for just a second, you know, I just got, you know, and I can't even say what I got, but I knew at a visceral level that I was. So at the time I had the privilege after I retired of living in the closest I believe I would ever come in this life to the Pure Lands, which is in northern New York State on what I call on the St. Lawrence River. And, So this is not a very sophisticated, everybody else had these incredible letters of motivation. So, I'd gone for a beautiful swim, and of course after a beautiful swim I always took a wonderful nap, and I woke up from the nap and I could see the clouds moving, you know, across the sky and wind blowing in the air, and I thought, well, what should I do for the rest of my life? And I thought, oh, I think I'll ordain. I think I want to ordain. So I called Geshe-la, and Geshe-la, I said to him, I'm done dancing around this. And he said, what does that mean? I said, well, thinking I want to do it and then ignoring you. And he said, oh, Kondala. And I kind of, Jeanette, and he said, well, this isn't a phone conversation. I said, well, yeah, you're right, but I just thought, and he said, well, I'm leaving soon. If you want to talk about this, you got to come back. So I left the river early. For anybody that knows me knows that was a great deal of giving up to even come back, leave the river before I had to. And so I talked to him, and he asked me some very serious questions and said, you know, I'm not prying. These are the important questions that the Vinaya requires. I said, no, go for it, you know, whatever. And he said, well, I need to think about it and come back in a few days. And I thought, and the only other thing, it doesn't matter. I told him, I said, Geshe-la, either you say, and it wasn't trying to put him on the spot. I said, Geshe-la, I'm not teacher shopping. I'm not ordination shopping. Either you say yes and you think it's the path for me, or, you know, I just accept that that's the way it is, you know. So I came back a few days later and a lot of people have prepared me and said, you know, don't expect to get a yes. Be expected to be given this to do or that to do or possibly or whatever. And, you know, it's not necessarily, okay. So I go into the house and starting to take my shoes off. And he says, oh, don't do that. This won't take long. And I'm thinking, well, no, doesn't take long. And this was like September. September, and so he said, well, I've talked to my teacher, and we both think it would be a good idea for you to ordain in December at Sarah J. Monastery. So you've got a lot of things to go take care of. Go away. You know, go about it. So August, I thought it would be a good idea. September, he said yes, and September, he said yes. December, I was in robes. What was my motivation? I would like to say that, you know, I would like to imagine that I was a being of great, you know, had reached a place of being a being of, we have the three scopes, you know, small, kind of beginner, maybe a little bit going along, and then, you know, really an advanced, you know, higher, well, I'm still at the small scope, guys. My motivation is I discovered that when I'm kind and when I do it with skill, you know, the lay version of wisdom and compassion, you know, be skillfully kind, I'm the happiest. And this path seemed to me to be the most practical way to do it. But really, the truth was, I just wanted to be happy right here and now. And so hopefully by doing that, maybe I'll get to the middle scope, maybe I'll get to the great scope, but I'm still, so my paint's still wet. I've only been ordained 3 years, and it'll probably be wet or damp until I die. So that's it. Thanks.
All right, as I mentioned earlier, my name is Lama. I'm the chant master of the center. I ordained on Sakadawa 2009 by Ken Rinpoche, the person who ordained Kandola, Chökyila. She's behind the pictures back there someplace, behind the vase, so you can't see it. I was Catholic when I was growing up, living in Japan, where there are all many, many Buddhist temples. We live very close to the Medicine Buddha temple. I never visited. And I wanted to become a Catholic nun throughout high school. My father was a Buddhist, but then he started going to Mass, and so I joined him. And even before I wanted to become a nun. And then during high school I wanted to. Anyway, and the reason I wanted to do that was because I realized very early in life that, you know, the people that you really depend on, you know, and for your survival, you know, your parents, your home life, whatever, were not dependable. You know, my parents were having problems, marital problems, so forth. So I thought there has to be something out there that's much more stable. You know, there's something I can depend upon no matter what happens. And so my father also had this very strong spiritual life. And so I turned to a spiritual life. So I turned to Catholicism. But anyway, I went to the university, I got married, I had two children, have a beautiful son and daughter. And then after 24 years, well actually, let's see, 22 years. No, let's see, 24, 19 years. My husband wanted F for a divorce. And so anyway, I had better lawyers. So anyway, he changed his mind. I changed mine. I forgave him. And then we had another a really good 5 years. And then he divorced me again. And then this time, I served papers on him. And anyway, we went through it this time. And it was, it was good for both of us. And during this period, it was a very difficult time for me. I didn't realize what devastation it was, you know, on my mind. It was all, you know, up in my mind. And I had to turn to something. I was looking everywhere for something to help me through this because it was affecting my family, my children, you know, my parents, my work life, everything. So it was just deteriorating. So I finally found, eventually went into Buddhism. I found a book in the library, and then a book by Thich Nhat Hanh on meditations. So I started on that, and then after I went to the opening of what was called, it's Marbles Museum now, but it used to be Explorers, and Thich Nhat Hanh came to open the to do that. And let's see what happened. What's the matter? Anyway, then when I was there sitting on the grass with other people, I found out that there was a group that was practicing in his tradition at the UUFR, the Unitarian Universalist Church on Wade Avenue. So I went there and I started practicing there. It was a very small group, very, very nice group. And then later I found out about the Kadama Center meeting in the basement. So I went there, and do I need to change the battery?
Let's just grab another mic.
Okay. Okay. And anyway, so eventually I figured out after, you know, listening to many teachings that I had, thanks to my wonderful ex-husband, you know, he had given me some money for my separation agreement. And I thought, well, this was, you know, like, and I never touched it, even though I freaked out all the time about not having enough money. And I decided that it would be enough, you know, maybe to help me to ordain. And my children were old enough. So by then, so that I thought that they would be, you know, be able to do without me. And so anyway, I had many obstacles to ordination. And Yeshua gave me some practices to do. And they were wonderful because they really helped me get ready. Get my mind ready for ordination. So I did that, and then I was all set to go to Sarah J to get ordained, but then it didn't work out. So let's see, I guess maybe, I can't remember, it was maybe 2 years later, Kenzen Rinpoche came to the Master Gurmei Ken Rinpoche, Jetson Los Della came to the center and ordained two men from Mexico and me here, right here in this room on Sacadawa in 2009. So I'm really a Kadamba Center nun, as you know, it's due to all your help that I was you know, able to do this, and to, of course, through the guidance of Geshe-la. And so, and then, before I was ordained, my father, I had been learning how to chant with Venerable Cherny, and I went to her classes on Nune and things like that. Anyway, she was trying to show us how to do Medicine Buddha Puja and Guru Puja and all those different chants. And I guess she must have been away when Chodron Rinpoche came to visit, and they needed a chant master. Geshe-la just turned to me and said, "Hey, Christine, tonight you're going to lead the the teachings tonight." And maybe it was the Guru Puja. It wasn't Guru Puja. It was just to be the chant master there. And it was like 2 months. It was about a month or two. It was about a month after my father passed away. So they said, "It's okay, you don't have to." Julie Lavelle says, "You don't have to do that." Lavelle Jones says, "You don't have to do that. It's very difficult." And I said, "No, I want to do it. That's exactly what I want to do." And it was wonderful. You know, Chodron Rinpoche, just his speech, you know, teaching, just coming out, pouring down like a beautiful rain, you know. It's wonderful because my father never rarely spoke, you know, to the family at all. So it was wonderful, you know, just to hear the teaching. Anyway, so that's how I got this job. But, you know, and the reason I was able to do that, it got to be later and later, ordination got postponed, and it was good because, I was able to retire, I knew financially that I would be able to support myself, because the first thing Geshe-la said was, you know, the center can't sponsor you. You have to do this on your own financially. So I said, okay, that's all right. You know, I'll figure out a way. And then I actually, after ordained, I went back to work, and I found out that I was going, if I could retire early, and then I could get early Social Security, so then that would be able to give me the opportunity to support myself financially and still be a nun at the center. So that's how I was able to do that.
So I hope that this has given you an appreciation, and I also hope that y'all have questions for any or all of the nuns, and we'll want to use the microphone for those who are streaming.
I was just going to ask Venerable Khandro if you could tell us a little bit about what you're going to be doing at Liberation Prison Project.
Lots. At Liberation Prisons Project, we needed to have somebody to coordinate all the work and all the effort to further inmates. And a lot of the work, not having someone local, was getting delayed. And so the guys were having to wait months and months and months before anything was sent to them. But not only that, you know, not only with the coordination and making sure things get out in kind of a timely fashion, I've been involved with Liberation Prisons Project for 6 years. And I've got my own students that I have been teaching the Dharma to. So not only do I do that, but I write the lessons for them. And right in the middle they're right in the middle of the first book of the Lamrim Kenmul, which I've had 5 years of teaching with Geshe-la in Jamyang Center in London. And so I'm teaching them that. And to see, you know, encourage them to see where they were when they first started with me in their letters is quite profound, to see the change in the way they speak, the way that they're thinking, and have that written down and to be able to go back to them and say, "Do you remember when you told me this 4 years ago, you said da 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 da," and then I can say, "What a change you have been going through and how wonderful that is," and to really examine where they were when they first came into prison. It's something I'm very, very passionate about. I know Dzogchen and I have very much like minds. I mean, Venerable Dzogchen, we can chat for 2 hours on Skype, no problem, about this project. She's just as excited and passionate about it as I am. So we kind of feed off of each other. And to really see that the program develops beyond where it is now. I talked recently with a judge, a former judge actually, retired, who works in Colorado, with youth offenders. Now, that's a tough group, right? They're tougher than the adults, okay, because they're no nonsense, and they'll spot a liar like that, right? If you don't have your dharma in line, they will start asking you questions, hard questions, and it tests your practice. The benefit to me is that I have to know what I'm saying. I have to really, really know it, because you can't fool a teenager. There's no way. I mean, because they'll call you fake. They'll call you a liar to your face. So we're jumping into that deep end, feet first, right? And we're going to pull him in and try to send him lessons for these guys and help him out and send books to him and support him as well. So we're adding on to LPP's project just now, and I haven't told Tokyo about this yet, so you guys know before she does, but she sent him to me, so she knew what I was going to do with it. I'm convinced she knows. I work with that most of the time, including my practice. I do a practice in the morning, practice at night, and in between I'm doing LPP stuff, so I'm like running around like a headless chicken. It's about 14 hours a day right at the moment, and I'm trying to cut that down and give myself a schedule. That's hard, because I see a paper sitting on my desk, and that's not a piece of paper, that's a person, that's a human being. And he's asking me for help. And how can I possibly ignore that? I can't. So I have to be really, really practice my, you know, this is your schedule, Kanzura, go to bed. So it's, I have to say, okay, tomorrow. But, and that's the hardest part, is for me to say, you know, do it tomorrow, because I want to do it all now. So I have to really practice and get the six perfections really kind of tested and stuff. So, but I'm looking for it to grow. I'm looking for, you know, volunteers to come and help us a little bit more. We're trying to create a schedule of some sort, but we're not there yet. I've only been here 4 weeks. So we'll get there, and then I can maybe discuss with the center here of, you know, what we've got planned as they kind of arise and grow on their own.
Just a point of clarification about, so for those of you who don't know, LPP is separate from Kadampa Center. It's, you know, another FPMT project, and it's run by a venerable Chuki, same name, different spelling. And so there's a lot of confusion, like when she said Chukila doesn't know yet, she doesn't mean me. So just so that everybody, that we'll still get confused, but just to at least help with that one little piece.
I'm glad you said that.
Just another, because it can kind of get confusing. We're really, really fortunate here that in a sense we have two prison projects. There's LPP prison project, and also there's the Kadampa Center prison project, and they are not the same thing. They are completely separate. And so I just, because it kind of gets confusing, because people say, oh, well, I tried to talk to so-and-so about it, and they're kind of not talking. So just be aware, we're really, it's really grateful that we have these two things, but they are, they operate completely separately and independently at the present time. Who knows about the future, but at the present time they do. So just, thanks. Just because there's always confusion about it.
That's okay. That's good, because I didn't know about this. Like I said, I've only been here for 4 weeks. So I didn't know about that part of it. But to really, you know, LPP has been something I've worked with, like I said, for 6 years. And I see it growing, because right at the moment it's gone a little bit stale, and it wasn't doing as well as I would have liked it. I do have a business administration degree. So for me, I see all the little holes things aren't working business-wise. And so I was kind of, you know, because I'm the monastic and the business thing and all my experiences that I've had in Nepal and India and everything else, Chukila, who is in Australia, right? And Jokala, who's also in Australia, I thought I was a good selection for coming here to America. And it brought me closer to my family. We live in North Hampshire, so it's fine. And it worked out just perfect because I didn't have a place to go. And so this has actually given me a home to stay in. So I'm just so grateful to everyone. And I've come to a really nice center with some really nice people. And that doesn't always happen either, right? I've been to centers where that's not the case. So you guys are rather special, so you should be proud of yourselves, really. You should be very happy that you have this nice, happy family and all this going on. It feels really good to come here, so I'm very happy.
I really have a lot of questions, but I'm going to try to minimize them. About the prison project, one thing I was wondering, like, with the inmates, when you select for the program, who is going to be in the program, they themselves, they want to have that change and they want to go, or you select based on... I don't know what they do.
What they do is they first contact us and they ask us, you know, what do you do? What's it all about? And then we give them a short answer because not everyone that comes to us is a serious student. We know that. Mm-hmm. Okay. Sometimes they want to do this thing about their ego. They want to be the big guru in the prison kind of thing, you know, and we run into that all the time. Or they ask us to do things like give them tantric empowerment so they can practice tantra, which is completely inappropriate. So it's really over the first three letters, they get the basics. They get Buddhism in a nutshell. They get, you know, just basic answers. And if they're still interested and want to continue with the course, they're assigned a mentor, a teacher. And that teacher corresponds with them and gives them guidance. How I've been doing it, and it's been working really well with my students, is they'll come back and they'll give me sets of questions that they've got about the course that I just sent them. And I'll answer the questions first and then give them the next lesson. Mm-hmm. And those lessons are taken from Loma Zopa. They're taken from many, many, many sources just so they get that a single point that they're struggling with. So it's not like I'm sending, and this is just from my students' mind, this is not, everybody doesn't do it exactly the same, because people who are mentors, they're kind of left to do things on their own, and we support them, but if you have an idea about how you want to do it, we let you do that. We don't tell you you can't. And so you give them the best answer that you're capable of and support them in a way that provides them information and gives them another voice, another way to think about whatever their questions are. So you're more than a pen pal. It's not just writing back and forth. You're teaching them Dharma. And so those are our serious students. And a lot of them will fall away. I mean, I started out with 20, and I've got like 6 that are solid students.
One thing that I was wondering, like us here outside of the prison, we live in a violent world that, you know, everything is unpredictable. And based on my own experience, I don't know how other people see, you know, just live their lives. There's a fear, you know, everybody fears to be robbed or, you know, or being commit some kind of crime against them or against their children and family. So, and I think we move like the aversion to criminals is based on the fear to be hurt, right? But when you practicing the Dharma and you want to be compassionate to them, and how you can you navigate that fear of being hurt by somebody,
mm-hmm.
and the compassion of them being just like you, like a human being that wants.
It's not easy to resolve that, and it took me a long time. Okay,
because I was doing the power, and I was having a hard time too.
Yeah. One of the things is a practice of the six perfections, okay? The generosity of the Dharma, right? Because generosity isn't just giving money. It isn't just giving gifts, or you buy somebody a mala, you send it to them. It's not that. Giving advice, giving support, giving the Dharma, that's part of the six perfections as well. Okay, and being supportive of somebody in a compassionate way is a difficult thing. Following the Bodhisattva path, it will make you cry, it will make you want to scream, people will lie, people will cheat, they will do all kinds of things to you because you're trying to do something good. And if you have an attachment to that and expect a reward from it, forget it. Don't do it because you're not going to get it. Okay? It's not going to come. Because as long as you have that in your mind, you will always be dissatisfied no matter what it is you're doing, whether it's a prisoner, whether it's somebody on the outside. And the truth is, we're all prisoners. Every single one of us in this room, we are all prisoners of 84,000 afflictions. Okay? Those 84,000 afflictions are like, and this is something I came from Thich Nhat Hanh, it's so funny. It's hysterical. And I have to tell you because it'll make you laugh. You know daycare centers, right? And everybody who has children, they're quite familiar with what they're like when you walk into the room. Your 84,000 afflictions in your mind, and this is the same for the prisoners, only more so, okay, because they can hear this. It's constant din, constant noise for them. They're all screaming children, right? It's like the daycare from hell, right? And you're the only teacher. You're in the middle going, oh no, what can I do? And the only thing you can do is deal with the child that's screaming the most. Right? They're all attached to each other, okay? Because as soon as you deal with one, there's another one that comes up, right? And this happens over and over and over and over and over again. Now, for you on the outside, you've got a little bit of what you think is control, okay? Because that's kind of a fib, as we tell ourselves anyway. But we think we do, okay? And we have a relatively peaceful existence because of that, we think, okay? When you're in a prison, that noise is on the outside as well as on the inside. So it's amplified, okay? It's constant racket in a prison. Even at night, it's noisy. And so you've got people fighting, screaming, yelling. You've got all of those 84,000 children on the outside where you can see them. Now, when you're developing compassion for someone, and you see that, you're going, there's no difference. Because what goes on in my mind is going on in his mind, only it's worse for him. And one of the things in the Vajrasattva Sadhana, it says, in Tibetan, we translate it as confession and sin. Okay? And I took Tibetan class and did a little bit of translation. I'm not an expert, so I don't think that I am. But I do it for myself, for my own understanding. And it says, I lay down and let go of my mistakes. It doesn't say confess. I lay my mistakes down and let them go. Right? So it's not about guilt. It's about getting them to develop remorse over their mistakes. They made a mistake, a very bad mistake. It's not them. Their action is the problem. Their view is the problem. You heal that. You heal the rest of it. And that sets them free. And so for me, that's how I see that when I write to them. That's my motivation. Their freedom, mentally.
Because your fear,
that fear never rises. It doesn't exist. It doesn't exist in you anyway. That fear is completely something that you've made up. It doesn't exist. If you look for it, you can't find it. It's here. And so when you start to slowly understand that they're just as trapped as you are, only more so, they're really trapped. It's like, oh my goodness, you know, it's like, I have so much, they have so little. They've made this horrible, horrible mistake. You know, hatred and anger and fear are our enemies in this life when we practice Dharma. So when we have, you know, a chance, an opportunity to address that by helping someone else who's worse off than we are, you know, an obvious way, or that we think that they're worse off, then that helps us develop ourselves. And the fear never, it doesn't come. You know, they don't, I mean, you're pretty safe for LPP because you don't give them your home address. They don't know anything about you. It's through a post office box. okay, so because we're not silly about it or anything. So we're careful, and that protects you a bit. But the rest of it's up to you. You know, it's like if you want to do something like this, then great. You know, come to me, talk to me, or do the other program, whichever one you want to do. But try. Make the effort. It's not going to be perfect, but it will address that fear. Okay.
One question. Do you, you mentioned something about volunteering, but I pretty much know by now that whoever volunteers have to have some sort of a training or understanding about the issues that he's going to encounter and how to transmit the message of the Dharma to this
That's my job. You come talk to me. I'll tell you what you need to know. No problem. I'll hold your hand. I don't let go of your hand.
Thank you.
Okay.
So this is a different question to address to all of you. Some of you, when you were telling us about how you became ordained, you talked about how you set up the causes and conditions for you to be able to take that step, how you organized the technical details of your life. And this is, it might be like a question that we don't ask a lot here in the West, but it's a very pertinent that you still have to live, you still have to eat, you still have to, you know, take care of yourself, your health. How, and some of you have done that through either retirement or jobs to provide for yourself monetarily, and you've mentioned that the center does not sponsor you. My question for you is, how can we as lay people support you in your choice to be ordained? Because I know I've taken a lot from, you know, just interactions with you, like just watching you do a puja or having you, you know, conduct a puja, and, you know, how it's changed my life. And so I just kind of wonder, like, how can we as lay people support you? Because I know traditionally, like, the center supports the monks, but the center doesn't support the nuns. So how can we help support you?
I guess in my situation, I do have a small retirement, but it's not enough to pay for a room. And so there's a lot of nuns that are like this that don't have enough to pay for just basic necessities. My case is like that. And I'm lucky that I've got John to stay with in LPP to kind of give me a room and take care of me. And I feel so utterly grateful. I mean, there's not enough words in the dictionary really to describe how I feel. And it's to really, I think, to be very, very aware and, you know, apply mindfulness really towards any nun that you meet, that they may not have enough, but quite often they don't ask because they're either shy or they just, you know, they don't want to say and seem like, you know, that they're imposing on people or whatever. Because in the West, it's kind of frowned on and anything. It's just not like it is in India or in Nepal. And just to really be very, very sensitive to the monastics, especially the women that come in here, that, you know, they're working very, very hard. I've seen a lot of my sisters go without just basic necessities, and I try to help them as much as I can, but I'm limited as well. But really just to keep that in mind and ask them, you know, can I help you, you know, and just say, no, it's a, you know, if they say, no, it's okay, then that's fine, you know, consider that your gift given, you know, once you do that, once you have that motivation, because that's very good as well. But, and then if they say, yes, you could give me a ride to a shop or something like that, it could be something really simple, you know, and those things do help a lot, even though they seem like they don't help very much, but they do. They make a big difference when somebody just, you know, offers you a ride or, you know, gets you a book or something like that, you know, just simple things that you can do. So it doesn't have to be grand gestures or anything, but just to be mindful and be really, you know, ask the nuns, you know, are you okay today? Do you need anything? You know, and really be sincere. I think it, I mean, just a gentle way, I guess. Maybe that's, if somebody's got another comment on that.
Um,
Just to follow up on people not asking, one of the, not that we're able to always do it because we've been invited to ask on occasion, but one of our vows is to not take anything that's not freely offered and really to not ask. I mean, that's kind of part of the path. So, you know, it's a funny bind in the West because if you kind of got to open your mouth and you know, it's just, so it's a kind of a proverbial rock and hard spot, you know, how to keep that protection and at the same time be open with people. And I will just add that the center is attempting, the center is, I think, at the beginning at this point, trying to begin to look at really doing support for Sangha in addition to, I don't mean financial support or in terms of income, but I think look at small ways in which there can be support for Sangha. So I think in terms of how to respond to your question, how can it be addressed, I think it can be addressed organizationally, if that's what the organization wants to do, and I think it can be addressed on an individual basis, as Venerable Khandro so eloquently said, you know, when it suits to you know, offer or to ask. But thank you very much for the question. I really appreciate it.
Oh, I'm sorry. I've got something else. First of all, I guess our circumstances are different. So I don't need any financial help at all. At this time, you know, things change, so it's different. But I think that what would really help is if you would give us an opportunity to help you. Like we have, we can do pujas, like if you're sick, or if you have a family member who's, or a friend who's dying or needs help, we'll be very happy to come to your home and do prayers for you and, you know, set up a puja, do that. You know, we have to have, you know, some notice, but we've gone to hospitals when people were dying, things like that. So just be aware that we're here for you. So, you know, just try to get, I think we all have, our individual emails addresses now through the Kadampa Center. Like I think it's yours is Khandro at KadampaCenter.org, mine's Lamo, and then there's Turkey at, you know, Kadampa Center. So if, you know, and then so that helps us too because then we gain merit. So please, you know, think of us when that helps. And then when I was also, are we out of time?
No.
Oh, okay. And then when my mother was dying, I got a lot of help, you know, from, center members, you know, and also from my sisters. So, I, you know, want to return that favor also, you know, to thank everyone.
Just to follow up on that, I think a lot of people heard Rinpoche at the retreat talk about how much more powerful prayers and practices are when they're done by those who have taken vows, which is what's behind this idea. Of course we do them on our own, but if we can request that those who have taken vows do the prayers and practices also, it just, the power of it just skyrockets. So thank you very much for reminding us that.
Also just on the point of offering material support to the nuns, something we can do immediately is that all of the offerings that are made to Kadampa Center in the offering boxes today will be distributed among our nuns. It's also, as I think Robbie mentioned earlier, it's always appropriate to make financial offerings to nuns. We sort of do it ritually when we have pujas, but you can always leave an envelope on their table or in their mailboxes if you wanted to help them in a quiet way.
I stayed at Tupten Choling Monastery in Wappinger Falls, New York. And what a lot of the Sangha did was they basically would take a certain amount of their own money and give it to the nuns for vitamins, for, you know, basic necessities. And that was, you know, a lot of, that got a lot of merit for them. And this was a way for them to support the nuns, whether it was $10, $15, and they would directly give it to the nuns every month for them to keep up their personal issues and stuff like that.
Yeah, I just wanted to say what it means to me to have and to be around a sangha. You know, like my first experience with Buddhism was when I was in Vietnam, and so what I saw visually, I saw monks, really, really resonated with me, and it really stuck with me. I wasn't even nowhere near ready to become Buddhist at that time, but it stuck. It stayed with me. And so when the time came for me to become, to look into this, seeing Geshe-la and seeing, I forgot her name again, the nun that died, Chuni, yeah, and then she helped me a lot, so I hate that I forgot her name, but just seeing that just really, made me feel like, this is where I'm supposed to be. This is home for me, you know. And so, whenever I'm in the presence of Sangha, I look at them and I see, and I don't know what they're doing spiritually. I'm assuming that they're working on their minds and stuff like that. You know, I'm assuming they are. But it really, really motivates me to want to work on my mind. It just really motivates me to want to become a better person. I think that if I wasn't married right now, and I would shave my head, and I would have no problem with wearing robes and stuff. But my path is a different one this lifetime. My next one, I hope that I can be a monk. That's my wish in my next life, you know. But I think it just means so much. And now we have got so many, you know. It just blows my mind, you know.
We need some monks.
We did have one, right? Yes, I remember. Yeah. So we need some. But I'm not ready. It's not my path. You know. But who knows what happens? I'm still young. I'm 65.
I think we're out of time. Unless we have one more question, maybe. Okay. Oh. Did you have one?
Sure. Okay. I was telling you before that I wasn't waving you away.
Oh.
Used without this. Hi, how are you? I have a lot of questions. Hi. But I'll just, it's too late now, so I'll just keep them maybe to one. I want to follow up on your question, Christy. I wasn't aware that only the monks receive financial assistance. Is that, without getting too far down the rabbit hole, is that tradition, or is that just Kadampa? Maybe this is a Robbie question.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Geshe Gelug and Geshe Thampa are here as resident teachers, which is an official position in the FDMC, and we have the guidelines of what we pay them and what we have to provide are determined by FDMC.
Is it possible then to designate, if you do donate here, where that money goes to? In a sense?
Well, I'm going to defer to our treasurer on that.
Okay, yeah, I don't want to get, again, too. And also, we can get into that afterwards. I was just curious. Also, back to the LPP, great work you all are doing. I wasn't aware that the communication and interaction was strictly via snail mail. Is that correct?
No, email.
Email? Okay.
For LPP.
Okay. Has there ever been an attempt to actually go down there to the prisons, the central prison? Oh, awesome. Okay, cool. Thank you very much. Happy Sunday, all.
I'll just repeat quickly for streaming that Robbie said that the reason the monks are paid is that they're resident teachers who come to us through FPMT, and they have a specific role here. Also, the monk who was here, Venerable Taye, had the same status as our nuns and wasn't paid.
Dave, if you wanted to address.
Well, as a treasurer, I guess I could say every year we do ask ourselves a question about whether we could provide more support for nuns, and we are edging toward that this year. We have set aside $5,000 for starting some kind of benefit of support for them this year, and I would expect that to increase in future years. Meanwhile, offerings to the center can be designated for special things, and if people wish to donate for a certain purpose, we can certainly consider that. I mean, we do honoraria and memorials, and we have special projects, and so I'd be happy to talk about that with anyone.
All right, for the dedication, would you please turn to page 246 in the Gold Prayer Book, or it's on the back of the same page. If you're in, if you have the white binder, it's on the back. It says dedication from Master Shantideva. May all beings everywhere, plagued by sufferings of body and mind, obtain a notion of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled with a mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvests. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be free from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may they never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid and those bound be freed. May the powerless find power and may people think of benefiting each other. For as long as space remains, for as long as sentient beings remain, until then may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world.
Thank you all very much. Thanks to our wonderful venerables. And I have just a few quick announcements. We can never get away on Sunday without announcements. First of all, you'll see here that we have this beautiful offer of alterings. We had a Tara practice last night, and we leave it up so that everyone can benefit from seeing them on Sunday. And there's an extra opportunity for merit to help taking it down afterwards. So if you're interested in doing that, please stay after. One of our Sangha members, Geshe Sangpo, his brother and sister-in-law who live here have they're in need of a babysitter for their son so that they can get to work. So if you're interested in doing that, come see me and I'll get you the contact for Kelsang. Next Saturday we're going to have a lightning reading of the Lam Rim. The Lam Rim is a foundational text in our tradition. It was written by Lama Tsongkhapa, and it's really beneficial to renew reading it on occasion. And we're going to do it monastery style, which means that among those who come here, we're going to divide up the pages and we're all going to read it out loud. And it's a kind of wonderful, joyous chaos, and it's a lot of fun to do. And that's going to be at 1 o'clock this coming Saturday. There's a garden planting going on in the morning and lunch at noon. So if you want to come and join for lunch and then stay for the Lam Rim reading, that'll be fun. Yes. And it's dedicated to Geshe-la. Yes. Thank you, Chukila. Yeah. And it'll be a great offering to tell him when he comes back that we've done this. Also, starting next Sunday, we will have another visiting teacher for 2 weeks, Jonathan Landau, who is maybe most famous as author of Buddhism for Dummies. And, of course, you need to know what you're talking about to write a book like that. He's a longtime student of Lama Yeshe and Lama Rinpoche. He will be here teaching on Sundays. He'll teach the first night of the How to Meditate module of Discovering Buddhism. He's got some great presentations about making pilgrimage and symbolism in Buddhist art. He's going to do a weekend workshop on how the 7-point mind training helps us to create happiness. And he's going to be teaching about Lam Rim on Wednesday nights. So please be sure to come for some of those. I need volunteers to help with some of that, so you can see me about that. And I think there's also, in the bulletin, I think,
how to log on and volunteer. And of course, we always need sponsorships for visiting teachers too. Oh yeah, and it's going to come out in your this week email also. And I think Vivian had an
Vivian. Okay, I'm Vivian. I am part of hospitality for Kadampa Center, and so what I am proposing, or hospitality is proposing, that we are going to do this month, starting next week or whenever this goes up, is called a service swap. It's kind of along the lines of what we've been talking, giving to each other. We are the strength of this center. We are. So here's a list. It's going to be outside, right outside the ladies' bathroom. And don't let location deter you. But I'm asking, we're asking, I mean, it's very simple, and it's member-driven. We manage this. It's not the center. It's us. And because what you give, you get back, and karma and all that, of course. But also, we have need, and we need to help each other. So if you have a gift that you want to offer as a service to someone else, that you're something you're good at, babysitting, transportation, tech support, whatever it is that you're good at, put it in the green. And if you need something, you know, put it in the yellow. You know, you need babysitting, you need tech support, whatever, put it in the yellow. And then just, you know, we take care of it. You find someone that has something you need, then call them. If you have something that you want to give and you see someone who needs it, call them. And we're going to do this for the month of, well, starting now to the end of November. Because what's at the base of this is gratitude. I am very grateful for Kadampa. They're family. We are family. So I'm very grateful for all of you, and I'm grateful to be here. And I think in giving, we understand what we have and what we have to give, and that's the base of everything, gratitude. So thank you, and it's outside. Oh, and if you guys want to continue this, please, by all means, this is member-driven. This isn't like Kadampa just running it. If this works for us, then let's keep doing it. But we're going to do it for now until the end of November and see where it goes. Okay.
So immediately breaking the statement that I'm not supposed to ask, I'm going to ask. I'm delighted that Jonathan Landau is going to be here. One of my challenges in life is that I cannot drive after dark. And so if anybody is coming to these teachings over the next 2 weeks and they would be willing to give me a ride, I would be extremely grateful. Okay? Thank you.